Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And we will introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for your family. Now, with over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in these areas of expertise. Now, we've got something a little different today because I'm coming to you live from the Yona Mountain Vineyard and Event Center in the foothills of the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains in northeastern Georgia. Why a vineyard, you may ask? Well, why not? Now, it's a beautiful property with a spectacular view, owned by Bob and Jane Miller, who, by the way, couldn't be better hosts. And with a storm coming through, were nice enough to allow me to transmit from here, where they have the most reliable internet connection in the county. Now, our guest today is Simon I. Singer, and he's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at the Northeastern University. Previously, he was professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He is the author of Recriminalizing Delinquency, Violent Juvenile Crime, and Juvenile Justice Reform, which won the American Sociological Association's 1999 Distinguished Scholar Award in Crime, Law, and Deviance. Now, in Simon's newest book, America's Safest City, he uses the types of delinquency seen in Amherst, New York, as a case study illuminating the roots of juvenile offending and deviance in modern society, a book that we just found out won the 2015 Hindelang Award, which is given by the American Society of Criminology for the most outstanding contribution to research in the area of criminology. Simon, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, we appreciate having you. I've had a chance to get into the book a little bit, and I think that you touch on some really, really important things as it relates to the way our juvenile justice system deals with juvenile offenders. And one question that I have is, why did you use Amherst, New York for your study and the comparisons?
Well, first of all, I had been where I've been working and living is in Amherst, New York. The University at Buffalo moved to this suburb, northeast suburb of the city that bordered the city. And it's a nice suburban city, and for a variety of reasons, I had a couple of kids, and my wife and I wanted to have our kids go to a good school. It so happens that the town had made a request to me, knowing that I was a criminologist interested in juvenile justice, to study their youth board programs. And with a couple of colleagues and graduate students, we did, and we surveyed kids, and we followed them up. The idea of producing a book, which turned out to be titled America's Safest City, comes from Money Magazine, which surveyed townships, cities of over 100,000. And, you know, the definition of a city has changed historically over time. So Money Magazine wasn't too far off in naming Amherst a city, although it's not a centrally located city, and that's why you have the suburban title in there. So Money Magazine in 1996, I believe, named Amherst America's safest city, and it's consistently been up there. Of course, the basis of safety is one of the points of the book, and I deal with that point at some length.
Yeah, what is some of the criteria that they're using to determine what a safe city is?
Okay, I think that's it's a very good question in terms of how do we evaluate safety based on criteria like crime. The Money Magazine used what a lot of people use, the FBI index category of offenses, and these are classified in what's called the Uniform Crime Reports. So they consist of seven index offenses. Arson has been added to the category. And I think there's general agreement that these are serious offenses. Of course, we can dispute one category of, larceny, burglary could be pretty trivial, but they also include the major violent offenses, murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. Now, when we get into that assault category, things can get a little tricky in mm-hmm. terms of what's classified as assault. So there's a lot of fighting, there's a lot of violence going on in our society and many other societies. The aggravated assault is with a weapon, knife, gun, and hospitalization as well. So there's a distinction there. So you could have a lot of simple assaults, and it wouldn't get into the Money Magazine classification of so-called serious offenses.
Now, in your book, you focus a lot on juveniles. Now, how are juveniles defined differently in the United States?
Differently from over time, and yeah. Well, first of all, we have a legal definition of adolescence, and that's been repeated in all sorts of documents. The Supreme Court recently said that, if following the age when people can vote and go into the army, if you're under 18, you're a juvenile. Some people would like to raise that, and some people would like to lower it. Historically, we could say that there was childhood and adulthood. This middle category of teenage years, that's really a function of industrialization, urbanization, and what some people, sociologists, like to refer to as modernity. There's two kinds of modernities out there, and I identify that in the book. One is more industrial one, and a more urban one that started to appear in the 19th century, the 1800s. And when we moved from our villages and rural environments more into the city. And then there's kind of post-industrial, de-industrial kind of modernity. And that happened in the latter part of the 20th century. It was part of the post-war suburban boom. And then we had the rise of suburban cities. So, you can go throughout America and you can, count a shrinking population in many cities, centrally located cities, and a large expansion of suburban communities, suburban development. So we often talk about a greater metropolitan area, and that's and businesses and universities. I mentioned the University of Buffalo. It moved out. It's not in the city of Buffalo. It's in this large suburban city called Amherst, New York.
Now, I understand that a lot of your research was done more so on suburban crime and delinquency. Why did you focus more on the suburbs? And which I'm glad that you did, because I don't think there's as much study that has been done or research that's been done on how crime has changed in the suburbs. So share with us a little bit about that as to how crime has changed, and are our suburbs getting safer or are they getting less safe?
Well, these are great questions. We have a divide in this country, and it hasn't got the divide. There's always been a class divide. There's always been a middle class. There's always been an upper class and a lower class. We can debate the quantities, the numbers. Has shifted from over time and place. But there's always been that divide. There's been less of a divide because we didn't have access to the automobile highways, and we often had that divide in closer proximity. So it was often in the city. So you had affluent neighborhoods, and you had less affluent ones, sometimes working class and sometimes really quite impoverished. So the crime rates in those cities was a compilation of those different classes. And you know, if you're in that middle or upper class environment, you're not so much compelled to do those street burglaries. So there's something else going on. You might be doing other things like fraud and things like that. So,
right.
The inner city, the central city, has become more impoverished. The disadvantage has become more concentrated. Some people in the 70s and 80s referred to white flight.
Right.
From the central city, public schools were conceived as not as good. Some people relate that to busing, a lot of fear, there's a variety of reasons. So when we look at the crime rates over time, what we're seeing is higher crime rates in the inner city. And as more urban folks go out into the suburbs are starting to look more like cities in many respects because they do have their differences. But the extremes are not, you have a lot of poverty in many suburban communities. Not all suburban communities are affluent. They're not all homogeneous. Not all inner cities are homogeneous in terms of poverty rates and disparities in terms of wealth. More of urban America is exemplified by cities like Buffalo, Cleveland, those mid-sized urban cities. But, you got a different mix, and I mentioned this in the book, in New York City, Boston, the rich people are right in the center, in Manhattan.
Right.
Multi-million dollar condos, that's the in place to live. And less affluent folks, the doormen, the truck drivers, you know, minimum wage. They're out in the boroughs.
Exactly.
You know, so there's a great deal of variation, and I live in the Boston area, and I see that that difference as well. European cities are very different than many American cities. A lot of poverty in suburban cities, tends to be a lot of high-rise government projects in many French suburban cities. So, so very, very difficult.
Well, and right now I'm in the South right now, and I'm seeing a lot more of the smaller cities that are being much more self-sufficient and are kind of focusing on like a smaller level of growth, and to sort of keep a more neighborly approach, which I think is working really well. But let me jump to the juvenile justice system, and we have an instant message that's coming across. And again, I want to thank everybody for those that either call in or you send in an email or an instant message. Know that I appreciate it very much. This one really cuts right to their opinion of the juvenile justice system. And this one says, I'd like to see our juvenile justice system scrapped and start over with a system that is based on rehabilitation and job training rather than housing and punishment. What do you think should be done?
I'm all for it.
Okay. Then not what do you think, you know, how do you think that could be achieved might be a better way to word that question to you.
Yeah. Well, as a sociologist with a a little history is quite critical here in terms of trying to understand what's gone wrong. And you know, it's important in our own personal lives. Would we think about, you know, if we got some crisis going on, we wouldn't try to go to the next step without understanding what the heck had transpired. Maybe there was maybe we're super depressed and, you know, there's some unconscious abuse or something. You know, I'm just saying that the history of why the system is the way it is right now is absolutely critical. And if I could just go over it in brief and relate it to your other point, your other question about, you know, what do we mean by juveniles? I gave you the Supreme Court definition. Yeah. I think we were a bit overly idealistic, creators of the juvenile court and the juvenile justice system. We're too idealistic and didn't really have a good sense of what it means to be an adolescent. They lumped that juvenile category in with childhood. And that, I think, was a mistake. And it was a mistake in the sense that people's common sense said, hey, this is a 15, 16-year-old. He's done something bad. He might have done something awful. When I say he, it could have been a she as well. Really, really terrible. You know, he's committed. He's hurt somebody. Could be very quite seriously. There's some punishment that's required. This person isn't a child. This person should know better. He's 16 or even 17 years of age, or even 14 or 13. So one of the things that was missing in that history is a good sense of adolescence and acceptance that we sometimes punish to treat. So this notion of total rehabilitation or treatment that has to be the end point. But
right.
How you get there got to be very confused. And the public, the common person, wasn't buying it. You know, if you're living in these in less urbane environments, and you know, your common sense says, you know, you do something wrong, you gotta face up to it.
Well, I think one of the issues, and as just to kind of wrap up the history part of it, I think one of the issues, and I've actually written on this subject, and it comes down to that our society has made changes based on what is financially beneficial. So mm-hmm. when teenagers came over, you know, on the boats from Europe, and they came over, they were needed to work on the farms. So mm-hmm. your teenager stayed with you, and they worked on their farms. When right. we became a more industrialized country, and you know, to quote Horace Greeley, you know, go west, young man, and mm-hmm. you had all of these teenagers going in and starting to work in these factories. Well, financially, not only did that hurt our agricultural industry, but now the unions came in, and the unions said, we don't want them bringing in these 15 and 16 year old kids to do this work, because we want to get paid a proper wage to do this job. So it then yeah. it then became financially beneficial to legislate against having these kids working, which now they've left home, they're on the streets, they're now a runaway, they were now criminals. Well, yeah. you know, bringing it forward now to about the 60s and stuff, and now we're trying to decriminalize somebody for just running away. So I think that, you know, now financially it makes more sense. You don't want to fill your jails with a bunch of kids for just running away. So I think at each stage we can see adults making financial decisions as it relates to these kids, and which kind of goes right to this person's question. And I think that, you know, they have a great point, and I'm so glad you agreed with it. You know, if we're working on rehabilitation, if we're working on treatment, if we're working on job training, then these kids are going to then be placed in a part of society that's going to allow them to earn an income and become a help to society. But if you continue to just house and punish them, you're not training them to do anything. They're going to come out. You've now have somebody who's not trained, and there's a much greater chance that they're going to choose a life of crime. So,
yeah.
So bringing that up to date, how do we now today, how do we make that change and make a shift outside of what this particular listener suggested, which was scrap it and start over?
Well, we need a tighter system, and we need a commitment to that rehabilitative treatment model, and I don't think that's there. So that you know, it's like so much in society, a lot of things are overly bureaucratic, with so many different divisions, and those divisions are there in our juvenile justice system as well as our criminal justice system. So when I say divisions, you have a lot. You talked about business interest. You know, there's a lot of financial interest in all aspects of the justice system. A lot of people have a lot of stake in different parts of it. And the idea of a juvenile court was not a bad idea, in the sense that you had somebody truly responsible. The image, the metaphor was like a benevolent father, the juvenile court judge would be, and he would really be involved in the fate of a troubled kid. And that, you know, with a lot of people getting involved, I mean, one way to view it is that every kid needs a parent. Uh-huh. It doesn't necessarily have to be a biological parent, you know, but somebody who really cares about them.
Yep.
And sometimes parents are deeply troubled. Sometimes parents get sick. Sometimes parents get or they die, or there's a divorce or something. But you need no child in a complex society, no adolescent can really, very few, let's put it this way, can really manage on their own. None of us can manage on our own.
Well, exactly.
We're living in a society, a community. So one way to think about this is in terms of how can we enable competent adults, whether they work for the system or not, to really take an active interest in troubled kids before they really become high offending criminals.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a great point when you bring up community, because if we don't provide a sense of community for them, then there are people on the streets, there are people that have criminal intent that will provide that for them. That's how gangs recruit. That's how, you know, these little criminal organizations recruit, is by being able to take these kids that in many cases have not been able to form a level of community.
Right.
And you know what I want to do is I want to take a break, but at the same time I want to share with everybody, if you want to follow along with us or if you want to be able to get the book, you can go to their website. Go to nyupress.org/books. You'll be able to see the book there. There's some information about the book that will kind of help you. There's some great reviews in regards to the book and such. So if you want to follow along with us, go ahead and go to the website, open up another window, and in the meantime, we're going to take a break. We'll be about 1 minute.
Could I add something there?
Please,
on the website, there's also a PDF of the introduction and table of contents, and for teachers, it's being used also in the classroom, I think mainly college classrooms, but maybe even high school could be used. There's also an instructor's manual.
That's wonderful. I appreciate you sharing that. So again, everybody, feel free. We're going to take a break, open up another window, follow along with us, and we will be right back with Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. We have with us Simon I. Singer, and we are talking about his new book, America's Safest City. And Simon, before the break, you mentioned something about the use of the book that you have teachers that are using it in high school and in college. So share with us a little bit how studying criminal justice and criminology and juvenile justice can help prepare a student to further themselves in the juvenile justice field, but also how studying it may educate them enough that it kind of keeps them from going in that direction to begin with.
Yeah, well, that's of course the hope. I think, you know, most of America and the vast majority of youth today are growing up in suburban environments. So this book has is what is referred to as a mixed method approach. I have qualitative ethnographic data. I tell stories. And there's some statistics there too from the surveys. So it's on a methodological note, you know, it tries to use the latest techniques to get closer to the truth. But the important point for most students is that they could identify with the subjects in these books, in this book, with the suburban stories, more so than with the impoverished inner city kids. Now, most of criminology focuses on the impoverished inner city, and it's quite important, and violent gangs, that's very important. It is responsible for a huge proportion of our violent crime rate. Most people, most of the kids who end up in our state prisons for serious crimes are coming from impoverished environments. They are often members of gangs. But I think it's important for the average suburban adolescent from a middle-income family to realize that they're not alone. If they have some troubles, if they've done some things that could have got them into the juvenile justice system, and they can reflect with some of the subjects of my book on the fact how fortunate they were that they weren't arrested or charged in juvenile court, and how especially fortunate they were, really fortunate, that they weren't incarcerated and labeled as a delinquent, or even worse, brought to criminal court, because the laws of waiver today are very, very loose, automatic in most states. So, you know, one of the statistics that that reviewers have noted repeatedly is the finding that 71% of my subjects in this town of Amherst, and these are based on multiple surveys, so they have some reliability. A good deal of reliability, I would say. 71% had committed an offense that could have got them into juvenile court or criminal court. It could have got them a delinquent or criminal label.
Now, what percentage of that, though, was drug-related?
A good proportion is drug-related. A good proportion. I don't have the exact percent. It's in the book, but a good proportion would be drug related. Another good proportion would be theft.
Theft related, right?
Yeah, theft related, and you know, and we're not necessarily talking about a $1 piece of gum or something like that. You know, some could be quite, you know. We tend to trivialize a lot of shoplifting because we think of it as small items, but they're not necessarily that small. And if the department store, private security, or the police wanted to make an official arrest instead of saying to the kid, you know, parent, don't you come back here, or, you know, you gotta pay us something for this theft. You got to settle for something. You know, if they wanted to prosecute, that could be quite serious.
Right. Now, in regards to your statistics, what are some of the statistics that when people read the book or when you're talking to them or when you're speaking that they are most shocked to find out?
Okay, so that's one statistic. Here I got another statistic. The high offending youth, those who reported not just doing it once, which would get them into that 71% category, but doing it many times, and especially the drug and alcohol. When we went back and surveyed them as adults, they desisted. Very few continued as high offending adult criminals. They might have been high offending adolescents, but the community worked, their families worked, maturation worked, brain development worked, you know, whatever. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that I listed worked, and essentially they stopped doing those things and they went on to have productive careers.
Okay, now let me touch on that just to make sure that everybody got it, because I you know, to me, what that says to the parents out there is there's a light at the end of the tunnel. You know that.
Absolutely.
You know that as you are pulling your hair out over some of these things that are happening, the majority of the time they're going to get through it. So.
Right, but the stories I tell of getting through, they're not getting through on their own. That's an important point to bear in mind.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
So what
and
are
that
the things?
That is the big difference between communities that have it together and have the resources, the insurance, the programs, the diversion, the maximum tolerance juvenile justice system, the rehabilitation programs, whatever you want to call it, to prevent their high offending delinquents from becoming high offending adult criminals.
Well, let's share which are there statistics that shares which things seem to be helping, or are you saying that all of these things together as a whole tend to work hand in hand to help them get to that point?
Yeah, I think it's also very important to bear in mind that one size doesn't fit all.
Yep.
That we need a potpourri of programs. It's like recreational activities. What do parents like about these suburban communities? Well, there's a lot of, it's not just that they got good schools, but they also have Little League. They don't just have Little League. They also have hockey. They have ice skating. They have, it's not that far from the dance studios, from music. You know, there's a lot of things that kids could be doing to have a great adolescence. And by the way, you know, while I'm talking about delinquency and offending, many kids do have a great adolescence. And it isn't all that, you know, it's an exciting period. It can be a very exciting period of time. But some kids are more troubled than other kids for a variety of reasons. And sometimes the troubles are so deep that they need a little more than just a weekly visit to a probation officer or a group class or something like that. They might need some intense therapy. Maybe the whole family needs some therapy. You know, this is where we're really a society as opposed to a village. We're a a society that consists of communities.
Right.
And this notion that we can go back to a village, tight village, is a big mistake. It's very important that parents realize that they can't necessarily do it on their own. And that if they have familial problems, things going on, that they have to, get it out. And may need to, parents are busy, both of them working, and, it could be, sometimes families need help. I tell the story of David O. in the book. Most of the stories are very good stories, but some stories are very sad stories. So not all is rosy in, as we all know, from Columbine and from these occasional shootings.
Share with us one of these success stories, because everybody that listens to this knows that as we we get close to the closing of the show, I love to hear a great success story.
Well, a great success story is, I tell it of one of the highest offending youth is Luke. And this is a story of, he had many chances. He did develop a heroin addiction. He was, he complained that he was bullied as a kid. That things were not working well with his family. He also felt that the reason he didn't take school and did poorly was that he had a learning disability. His parents, even though there was a lot of conflict reported, and we followed up with Luke, his parents really stood by him through a lot of serious trouble, and the system was not that quick to label him a delinquent, or for that matter, when he turned adult and he had a serious traffic accident because of he was a little too high. Much too high. The judge gave him an opportunity to go into rehab, and the accident and the threat of criminal court made him take rehab quite seriously, and he did it. He became drug and alcohol free, and went back to school. And last we spoke to him, it took him a while, 26, but he was just about finishing Buffalo State College. So I tell his story, and I tell him quite a few good stories like that.
Well, and that's the thing that is, sort of the cherry on top. That's, we try to do what we can to help, and I'm so glad that you brought up about therapy and that you brought up about various programs out there. There are programs out there that can help. There are people out there who have dedicated their life to help these young people. We just need to have a system that allows us to get them to them. And which goes right back to what this listener said, is that putting them in juvenile hall so that you can house them and punish them is not the answer. And when we have the caring people, we have to be able to set things in motion to where we are getting them to where they can get the help. And just as you brought up with this situation, there are many situations in which there are happy endings. There are many young people out there, as you said, that in many cases, they eventually, through maturing or whatever, they get to that point. Putting them in jail where they can learn how to be a better criminal is not going to be the answer And the sooner we understand that, and the sooner we focus our funding and such to places that are going to help, that are going to train, that are going to rehabilitate, those are the places that I think are going to help. And I'm glad that it sounds like that's what you're trying to lead people to in your book.
Yeah. One of the additional points that I make is that some kids do need to get away from their home environments, and they do need to get away from their gang of or group of friends. You know, you could say that more so for the kids in the impoverished inner city, where, you know, there is quite a bit of a street corner and gang culture. But they shouldn't be in a prison.
Right.
What they need is some kind of good boarding school.
Yes.
With all the services and the intense education. You know, that's expensive, and that requires a big commitment that the middle and the upper class the upper middle class, I would say, can afford. And, yeah.
But you know what, and I'm glad you brought that up, because when you talk about that it's expensive, to me what's more expensive is when we don't do it. You know,
absolutely.
You know, so there are special ed funds, there are school district funds, there are juvenile justice funds, there's county mental health funds. There are government entities that are set up to be able to do that, and we can either spend a little bit now for them to go to that special school, or we're going to spend 10 times more than that when we're now dealing with them from the standpoint of crime and prison and so on, and which then can also become welfare. It can also become having to deal with their medical issues or whatever it is. Let's spend a little bit now and not spend a lot later.
Yeah, absolutely. And morally, I think we all have an obligation to help those who are troubled. And
all right,
would be a sign of some kind of trouble.
Well, Simon, I got to tell you, we are just about out of time. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for writing the book. Again, for anybody out there, if you want to check out the book, go to nyupress.org/books. And you can check it out yourself. If you're driving and you can't write that down, go to our website, Answers for the Family. We will have all of Simon's information right there. Simon, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. I enjoyed this very much.
You're very welcome. And everybody out there, please tune in next week when we will discuss the miraculous ways to conquer cancer and awaken the power of healing within you. And if you miss a show or you want to share this show with your friends, please visit our archives at answersforthefamily.com. And the next time that you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by and like our page and share with your friends. The more people that we can get that listen to this, the greater influence we're going to have to get out the very positive message that we have. Everybody, have a great week. Be with us next week. Be good humans. Thank you. Good day.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.